The Debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. On Saturday, multiple explosions took place in the Afghan capital of Kabul. The death toll has risen to 68. Most of the casualties have been high school girls as the explosions took place outside of the school when the girls were on their way home. At least 160 others were also wounded. Now, the Afghan government has blamed the Taliban. However, the Taliban has denied involvement. What is going on in Afghanistan as we have seen a rise in attacks since Washington has announced its pull-off from the country by September the 11th. Let's cross over to Kabul, joined by Amin Alami. Amin, thanks so much for being with us. Please fill us in on the latest situation.
Well, Marzia, Kabul residents witnessed another tragic day as back-to-back explosions hit a high school in western part of the capital, Kabul. According to official statistics, at least 68 civilians, most of them schoolgirls, were killed and over 150 others sustained injuries. Most of the injured victims of this incident were shifted to nearby hospitals as well as to Kabul's emergency hospital for war victims. I went to the blast scene as well as I visited some of the victims of this incident in Kabul's emergency hospital. Marzia was one of those students who has sustained injuries. She said that when we were leaving the school to home, a huge car bomb blast happened in front of the entrance gate of the school, and then I cannot remember what happened. Another man who was a shopkeeper also said that when I heard a very loud explosion, I rushed to the blast scene as I was looking for my own daughter there. He also said that after a few moments there was another blast, and it was a roadside bomb blast, and after a few minutes there was the third blast. That is why the casualties are high. According to witnesses and local residents in Kalainau area in western part of the Afghan capital, Kabul, the blasts were too huge, and most of the families who live close to this high school have lost one or two of their family members. This comes as the Afghan government, specifically the Afghan President Mohammad Ashraf Ghani, strongly condemned the incident and blamed the Taliban militant group for being behind such attack. But the Taliban also released a statement and condemned the attack and said, "We are not involved in launching attacks on civilian targets." But in the meantime, let's not forget that the Afghan capital, Kabul, as well as many other big cities of this country witnessed similar attacks in the past as well. Most of those attacks were claimed by the Daesh terrorist group. For instance, I can point out at least three deadly terrorist attacks on educational centers in western part of the Afghan capital, Kabul, that claimed the lives of at least 150 school students and university students that were claimed by the Daesh terrorist group. However, the rise of insecurity and bloodshed in Afghanistan comes as there are also efforts to bring peace and stability to this country via relying on negotiations.
All right, thanks so much, Amin, for that.
Is one of the players that stress on following the negotiations. Besides the Afghan government, the people of Afghanistan and many other rights bodies as well as independent international bodies also call on the Taliban, as well as on what they name it, the supporter of Taliban, to say yes to the demand of the Afghan people. And
thanks so much. I mean, I think you have a delay. I'm not sure if you can hear me or not, but that we're going to end that with Amin Alami, correspondent in Kabul, because I definitely want to get to our main guests for this program. I'd like to welcome our guests, Madia Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink out of Washington, D.C., and Elijah McNear, journalist and political analyst out of Brussels. Thank you both for being with us. Madia, let me start with you. I mean, we look at the situation in Afghanistan and this unbelievable violence that is taking place, and we look at the involvement of the United States, 20 years in that country. What has been accomplished? Because it definitely seems that security is one of those things that has not been really brought to Afghanistan. So what has the U.S. been doing in that country all these years?
Well, it's quite horrific that after those 20 years of U.S. occupation and billions and billions, if not trillions, of dollars being spent, including $88 billion just training the Afghan security forces, that the U.S. and the allies have not been able to build a stable democratic government in Afghanistan. And so the violence is a testament to the fact that the United States has been part of that violence rather than being any solution that would bring peace and security to the Afghan people.
Elijah, we have seen an increase in attacks in Afghanistan recently. Why do you think that this is happening at this point in time? On the one hand, if we look at the attacks yesterday, the government pointed a finger at the Taliban. The Taliban denied involvement and said they do not attack civilians. And as our correspondent said, it has similar earmarks to what Daesh and others have been doing. But overall, what's your perspective about this increase?
Yes, I do really agree with your correspondent. This has had the fingerprint of ISIS rather than the Taliban. There is also a significant indication of the failure of the local security forces. I mean, the car has been there for 24 hours, and this area has been targeted before. And ISIS doesn't really target specific objective to send a message, but it's a random against civilians. This is not the way that Taliban has been doing, particularly after the negotiations that has been held in Qatar and in other places, and the will of the U.S. to withdraw, although the U.S. did not respect its deal that was concluded by Donald Trump of the withdrawal of the 1st of May. And that increases the tension in the country and increases the instability. And now Biden is saying he's going to withdraw by the 11th of September. And that puts also Taliban off its commitment, because it is not guaranteed that Taliban is not going to stop attacking the U.S., particularly when the U.S. are continuing to bomb areas under the Taliban control. Therefore, it is obvious that the security in the country is going to be hectic as long as the Americans are there and as long as there is no national reconciliation among all parties.
Yeah, why do we not see international condemnation and outrage at this increased number of attacks and fatalities taking place in Afghanistan? I mean, if we look at the situation yesterday outside of a girls' high school, if it had taken place anywhere else, we would be seeing so much people condemning what has taken place, memorials set up to remember the victims. Why isn't that the case when it comes to Afghanistan?
I think a lot of the world has turned a blind eye and washed their hands of what's going on in Afghanistan. The violence has been going on for more than 20 years. And here in the United States, there's a sense of let's just get out of there and get over this. So I think such a horrific attack that, as you say, would have made headline news all over the world is really disregarded and seen as just a part of the landscape of a place like Afghanistan. And it's just astounding that there's not more of an international outcry.
I mean, you talked about the United States. Let's talk about inside the United States, because in general, when something like this happens, exactly like you said, in a country like Afghanistan that has been under violence so long, Medea, people basically sometimes look at, well, that's just how they are over there, and not connecting the role of the U.S. government and the troops, the American troops that are there, and the lack of stability in this country. Your take, Medea.
Yes, I think the narrative is those people just fight each other. And one has to question the role of the U.S. and also where do all these weapons come from? And so much of the weapons on all sides have come from the United States that has just poured weapons into Afghanistan and all of the Middle East. So many of the U.S. weapons companies have become enriched by this violence that's ongoing in Afghanistan and the larger region. And if the United States, after 20 years, was not able to bring any kind of stability to Afghanistan, then it has to be questioned, what was it doing? Why is the government in Afghanistan so corrupt? Was the U.S. part of this corruption? Well, of course, pouring all this money in, and the U.S. military can't even acknowledge where many, many billions of dollars goes, and then blames the Afghans for being corrupt and blames the Afghan for being violent.
Elijah, in any situation, I mean, if we look at these attacks, usually we ask the question, who benefits from these attacks? And you said that it was not the trademark of the Taliban, these attacks that took place yesterday, but more likely Daesh. If we look at then Daesh, and who has supported Daesh, and who has armed Daesh, does it not lead back the trail to many Western capitals?
This is a very good question. We've seen since the war in Afghanistan, 2001, we saw the growing of the Mujahideen that goes back to the U.S. finance during the Soviet era and the Soviet war in Afghanistan. And this is exactly what Hillary Clinton said. The people we are fighting today are the same people we have funded. This is really from the mouth of the foreign minister, the U.S. foreign minister. And as your guest said, I really agree. We see corruption wherever the U.S. are going. We saw that in Iraq. It's exactly the same, hundreds of billions of dollars. We see the increase of Mujahideen. We see the increase of ISIS in Syria. The Americans watch them growing in Iraq and crossing from Iraq to Syria, and said nothing, and then supporting these terrorist groups also in Syria, training them and financing them. So it's exactly, history is repeating itself. ISIS is in Afghanistan as it is in the rest of different parts of Africa and the Middle East, but is also, we see how strongly the U.S. invested in destabilizing the area, and it is time for them to leave, but leave not only Afghanistan, that leave Iraq and leave Syria.
But in your perspective, does the U.S. profit from a lack of stability? We see, for example, well, we're talking about Afghanistan right now, so I'll leave it right there with Afghanistan. Does the U.S. benefit from a lack of stability in these countries?
Well, certainly there's a sector of the economy in the U.S. that benefits all of these defense contractors, military contractors, that have made so many billions of dollars in the last 20 years want to see these wars continue. But I certainly don't think it's something that benefits the American people, because we have been paying for these wars instead of the money going into healthcare and education and things that benefit people in this country. They've been going to support the violence and the chaos that the U.S. military is part of in Afghanistan and elsewhere.
Elijah, your prognosis in general, with the situation that has happened, of course, the U.S. was supposed to leave in May, and now it says in August, and as you said, technically, then there's no agreement between the U.S. and the Taliban. Now, do you see these talks continuing at this point, or your prognosis, especially for the next few months?
I think talks to reach a conclusion in Qatar, and when the Americans sat with the Taliban and concluded the deal, there is no more talk to be made, at the exception of the U.S. leaving the country. However, we see alarming indication from the U.S. saying we will not completely leave and we will keep a kind of counterterrorism units to keep watching what's happening in the country.
Yes.
I mean, after 100,000 troops, they didn't manage to do so. Taliban today control 30% of the districts. The other 30% are also contested. Therefore, after 20 years with 100,000 troops, what the hell the Americans are still doing in the country? There is no justification. The deal has been made, and they should have respected it, and they should have left on May. And now Biden is begging for the Taliban not to attack, because during the attack, the forces are more vulnerable. And Taliban said, we're not going to respect it because you did not respect the deal. So that's it.
Well, Elijah, what do you think that means, this anti-terror group that Washington says has to remain? What do you get from that?
I get that they will keep some kind of control on the local government. They would like to keep the dictate on the government in Kabul to make sure that their interests are still looked after in the country. Therefore, I don't think the Americans will permanently leave and definitely let the Taliban and the central government and all the other groups sit around the table and sort out their own problems. That's also not something easy to achieve. A domestic national reconciliation is not going to be so easy, but the Americans would like to keep a foothold in the country, and that is under a different title, and that they call it counterterrorism. If they consider the Taliban are no longer a threat, then there is no reason to keep the counterterrorism units in the country.
Your take on that, Madia, because we've seen, for example, we saw troops leaving Iraq, but then not really leaving Iraq. And now, as our other guest has said, about the anti-terror troops that Secretary of State said that would be left there in Afghanistan. Your assessment of all this, when the United States sees a situation, for example, Afghanistan is very important to it strategically, do you think that really that Washington is going to totally leave Afghanistan?
Well, it will certainly maintain the ability to come back in with airstrikes, with drone strikes. There will be CIA operatives. There will be people still training the untrainable Afghan military after 20 years of training. So they won't be totally gone. But I do think it is a positive thing. I agree that the troops should have left by May 1st, and it would have made the withdrawal easier. But I do think it is a positive thing that the U.S. troops will leave, and hopefully most of the contractors as well. But let's not kid ourselves. The U.S. is not going to totally wipe its hands from Afghanistan. It wants to maintain some ability to go back in.
Well, Madia, based on what you're saying, then do you see continued instability? Because if we're talking about drone strikes or being able to attack at any time, so it means, for example, if Kabul, if the government or whichever government is in power by that time and doesn't walk the walk that the United States defines, then wouldn't it be even easier for them to cause even more instability, and especially with CIA operatives on the ground?
Well, we've seen from this attack, if indeed it was ISIS, that there is that there are different kinds of groups. And let's remember, there are all kinds of warlords in Afghanistan that will be jockeying for power. It's not just the Afghan government and the Taliban. So there will be, unfortunately, a lot of violence for years to come, because there are so many different groups vying for power, and there are so many weapons. And this is become the occupation of so many of the Afghan men that I don't think we're going to see an end to the violence in the short term.
Elijah, your prognosis for Afghanistan beyond August?
I really agree. I don't think there is going to be stability as long as there is no national reconciliation in the country. And that is really important to allow the Afghani to sort out their own problems. Whatever time they need, how long they need, it doesn't matter. Even, yes, I agree there are many warlords the country has been under a war for 20 years. That's not easy. There's a lot to be done. Reconstructing also the souls and the national reconciliation. That is not going to be easy, but it will take time. But it's better to start with without the Americans, without the presence of any foreign troop. Let the people of the Middle East and the West Asia sort out their own problems.
And, Madia, 1 minute I have. I mean, this war was started in 2000 war, allegedly the war on terror by George W. Bush. In your perspective, what has been accomplished in these 20 years by the United States in Afghanistan?
Countless numbers of Afghans killed, millions displaced, millions wounded, thousands of U.S. soldiers, over $1 trillion U.S. dollars sunk into all of this chaos and bloodshed. That's what's been, quote, accomplished in these 20 years, and it's horrific. And unfortunately, on top of all that, I don't think in the U.S. the lessons have been learned that we shouldn't go in and invade and occupy other countries.
And with that note, I appreciate both of you being with us on this debate. Madia Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink out of Washington, D.C., and Elijah McNeil, a journalist and political analyst out of Brussels. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality. Back to
Reality. It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program, Back to Reality on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Javad, and our dear guests. Let me ask them to introduce themselves.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. I am Zainab, totally stoked to be here with you guys.
Thank you. And, brother?
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you very much. My name is Sayyid Ayman Rizvi, and I've been studying in the Hawza for the last 8 years, living in Qom.
Great. Sister Zainab, is helping others still a sign of civilization? You know, we know this from a kind of article. There was this student who once asked Margaret Mead, the American sociologist or anthropologist, what he knows to be the first sign of civilization in a culture. Well, the students expected the anthropologist to
like
talk
be
about
a coin or a weapon or
yes,
vase.
Earthenware,
exactly.
pots, pottery, you know, masonry
and stuff like that,
you know. But Professor Mead, in fact, said that the first sign of civilization in an ancient culture was the evidence of a person whose femur was broken but then healed.
Oh, yes.
So Mead explained that in the animal world, in other mammals, well, you die. You basically die if you break
like,
your leg
exactly.
or any limb.
Predators
right.
will come and get you.
Exactly. And there is no other, like...
aid, support,
aid,
help.
Support, whatever. You cannot escape the danger. If you go to the river to drink water, for example, you look for food, or you become food
immobile.
For
exactly.
other
animals,
animals, for prey for other
exactly.
hunters or predators, you know? So what do you think of this? Do you disagree with Professor Mead, or you have something else to talk about as a sign of civilization?
Is helping others a sign of civilization? Is helping others a sign of civilization? My question is there any other sign of civilization? Helping others, I think it's what makes us human, not just civilized. It's the core... essential, innate, most natural, yet pivotal, salient attribute that makes us human.
Mm-hmm.
Like you said, in the animal kingdom, you break a leg, your own mother abandons you, because
yes.
if she sticks around, she's going to starve. The other cubs or puppies or kittens are going to starve to death. And there's no hope for you surviving anymore, because it's the survival of the fittest. And I think when Darwin... push that theory forward. I'm pretty sure he only meant it for the animal kingdom. It doesn't apply to human beings at all, because contrary to what a lot of people might try to prove, that it's a dog-eat-dog kind of world and we're each other's sharks, we're not. We're human beings. We walk on two legs, and we're filled with compassion and with love. Mm-hmm. And no matter how successful we want to be in life and how much we want to achieve, nothing will give us more fulfillment. Nothing will be a more significant achievement in the eyes of a sound human being,
yes,
than the ability to be selfless in
right.
order to help others.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This selflessness, does that ring a bell to you, Brother Ina?
Of course. Human nature is all about helping others. Because, you know, if you help someone, those sentiments or feelings of happiness mm-hmm. which you have gained through helping someone would stay always in your heart. You would always remember it in a good way.
Mm-hmm.
It would give you some sort of energy.
Right.
And if you hurt others, that also gives you some sort of, not energy, but it's some kind of a pain.
Yes.
That you have hurt someone.
Yeah. Something
you will always,
to be lingering in your mind all the time.
Yeah, the guilt will eat you up
guilt.
Alive.
Yes. Yeah,
exactly.
That's the right word. The guilt will remain in your heart. So these, emotions or the sentiments basically stays in your heart forever. And you know that Mother Teresa, for example.
Yes.
You know, we don't want to talk about the history or details, but, she's famous for her help.
Yes, exactly.
So everyone loves her, right?
Yeah, she said something which was quite impressive when I heard it or read it somewhere, that she said a helping hand is better than
a praying
mouth.
MashaAllah.
Mm. Well, something like this has been
said. I think it's a hadith.
Sure, I mean, all the great people, they
yes.
learn from other great people.
Exactly.
So there's a hadith that, I think it's by Jafar Sadiq alayhi salam. He says that people are like God's family, and, the most beloved people from God is the one who benefits the people,
mm-hmm.
Make families happy, help their brothers in the times of needs.
Mm.
And this helping is better than 2 months of itikaf in Haram al-Kaaba.
SubhanAllah.
Mm.
So just imagine that, what kind of reward it has and what kind of importance it has. So, there are many ahadiths.
Yeah. Exactly.
Which
that actually
that
reminds me of a narration from Nabi Musa ala Nabina wa alayhi salam, and he was saying that God, and the conversations between Nabi Musa and God are just like on a whole other level.
Yes.
And he was like, God, if you were a human, what would you do to please God? And he was like, I'd serve other people.
Mm-hmm.
That's like your one-way ticket,
yes.
your freeway, the key to God's heart. That's yeah, how you get on God's good list. That's how you go get into heaven.
So helping other people, serving mm. the society,
mm.
if that brings you so many benefits, if that is so much, what's stopping people to help others?
Greed, I think, materialism,
mm-hmm.
and the fact that they think they're going to live forever, maybe.
But everyone knows that they're going to die one day.
I think we know it, but we don't believe it.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean?
Yes,
and then
I do.
When death actually comes, we're like, is it my time already? It's
yeah.
always a surprise,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, it's always a surprise.
Yeah, unless you're Amir al-Mu'mineen, no one was anticipating their death.
Mm.
But in recent times, they say that, for example, if I have to die, mm. then why not, enjoy? So this is the new notion, right?
Entirely. Like the whole thing of YOLO, you only live once. No,
yes.
you only die once. You live every day,
yes.
right? And once you do die, you have a hereafter to be, to answer for. You have, eternity to answer for this period of time that you were
temporary.
Here. Yeah, for the temporary fleeting time,
yes.
60, 70, 80 years that you had here. And Jesus Christ, if you don't have the right answers, then you're done, man. How are you going to... But because people don't believe in that, they're they become each other's sharks. And they're like, oh, if I don't collect every material possible object in this world for myself, if I don't hoard it, then that person is going to get it. Mm-hmm. And they're going to be more successful and more prosperous, when they don't understand that success and prosperity is what you make for yourself in the hereafter.
Yes.
And what you give for God, for others in the name of God, is what that lasts.
Mm-hmm, I see.
What you spend for yourself really doesn't.
Brother Eamon, what do you think? What's stopping people to help each other out?
Well, usually, you know, all those pollutions, you know, and what I mean by pollutions is basically, you know,
pollution of the heart.
Pollution of the heart. Mm-hmm. But in recent times, we know that, you know, in the name of modernism, there is a consumerism.
Mm-hmm.
People are more eager to enjoy their lives. Whatever they have, whatever the resources they find, and, you know, just they believe in the notion that this is a limited life.
Mm-hmm.
So why not enjoy? So they just want to enjoy their life only.
Yes.
They just
and
want to spend all the money.
Everyone else, even if your neighbor has a problem, you say that that's their baby, that's their problem.
I have
it's nothing
lived,
to do with
I have lived in States, and I have seen that, you know, I don't even know my neighbors. You know, if I'm living in a apartment complex, neighbors don't know each other.
Yeah. Mm.
This is the new, you know, consumerism world. There's a new modernism world in which people are not related to each other at all. If we come to the Islamic teachings, there is a one big solution I saw. One scholar was also mentioning that only this hadith, if we practically follow on this mm-hmm. hadith, the life on earth will become like a heaven.
Yeah,
and this hadith
flourish.
This hadith is about the neighbors.
Mm.
Prophet said that just take care of your neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
And once someone asked him that, who are my neighbors? So, you know, he mentioned that, you know, it's like 40
houses,
yeah,
40 north,
houses
west,
on
south,
every
east.
Side, every side. So if, just imagine if every person is taking care of the 40 houses in
every
direction,
direction.
Mm-hmm.
This whole world will become a paradise.
Exactly.
Automatically.
Exactly.
And Quran also tells that, you know, there are many verses in the Quran and Majid that tells that enjoining goodness
yes.
to parents, to orphans, to needy, to relatives. Mm-hmm. It's just over and over Quran has mentioned these, you know, these things. So it means that it is something which is a human soul belongs to.
Mm. And the fact that Islam emphasizes on it so much, I mean, on one hand, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that Islam is the religion of your fitra, right? Your innate
yes,
nature.
Exactly.
Yes.
And on the other hand, he's emphasizing on these things through the teaching of Islam. It's like 2 + 2 equals being kind to other people is human nature.
Yes.
Right? And like what you said about the neighbors, it reminded me of another hadith from Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wa sallam, that His Eminence said, Jibreel advised me regarding my neighbor so much to a point that I thought they would inherit from me. That's how important, you know, kinship and neighborhood and that sense of unity, solidarity mm-hmm. is in Islam. And I think if Islam made it, I mean, looking back at history, if Islam made it anywhere, if it was till any point known as one of the greatest civilizations is because of this sense of solidarity they had up
right.
to a certain point, and then after a while it just faded out, and then we got labeled as terrorists.
Mm.
But when like the Muhajireen, the immigrants, they came from Mecca to Medina, and Rasulullah said, love them as you love yourselves
mm-hmm.
and share with them whatever you have in your homes.
Yes.
The Ansar, they literally took them immigrants from Mecca as one of their own. I mean, how much more compassion could you possibly want?
Yes.
Total, absolute strangers
yes.
from a whole different city. You've never met them in your life.
Mm-hmm.
You open your homes to them
yes.
and you love them so, so very much. And
yes.
you like lay down each other's lives for one another. And it's just a shame that it's all gone, you know,
yeah.
to such a huge extent.
Brother Eamon, this kind of help, you're talking about helping others.
Yes.
Lots of people think that since they are not well-to-do or rich enough, they are exempted from this, let's say, this act.
Oh, yeah.
All right?
Mm-hmm.
This kind of, let's say, compassion toward other people. And they, whenever you think of compassion, you automatically think of money.
Mm-hmm.
Or helping people with, like, who are like the needy, like the beggars or something, and yes. all. And you need to give them money so that get rid of them.
Yes,
all
exactly.
right, one way or another. Yeah. So, what other forms would you think of helping to come in the form?
I think the biggest thing you can do is basically enabling others through your knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
I personally have taught many kids in my neighborhood free of cost because I knew that they were unable to pay.
Mm-hmm.
And alhamdulillah, I've seen many of them that they learned something from me, like I taught them English or I taught them some other things.
Mm-hmm.
And now they are in a better places. They,
very good.
Alhamdulillah. So I think you can enable others through your knowledge
yes.
by spreading it.
Mm-hmm.
And some other things you can also do, for example, other than spreading knowledge, you can comfort others in the times of pain.
Oh, that's so true.
Yeah.
Yes.
Some people are
like
always in pain.
Being a crying shoulder.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Exactly. If you can do that, this, I think it's one of the biggest helps. You know, it's like a divine help.
I see.
Because some people just die out from
exactly.
their pains or problems. And if you can just make them stand up.
And give them hope.
Give them hope.
Subhanallah.
To live their life. This is, I think you can get a heaven.
Greatest act
just
of
by
kindness.
This action, you know.
Exactly.
So take care of others, you know, by this trait as well.
Sister Zainab, what about you?
I would totally have to agree with what my brother said. Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam says, smiling at the face of your brother in religion mm-hmm. is an act of charity, right? So if we're going to be kind to one another, it doesn't necessarily have to be like, I'm going to let my best friend borrow some money, or like, you get to keep that money even. It's just the fact of being there for each other and letting them know they're not alone in this world. That
yes.
is so important.
Even a smile could do.
Exactly.
Work.
It could
magic.
Like turn a
yeah,
person's
magic.
Day.
Magic, yeah.
It could make their day. A simple word of affirmation.
Exactly.
Hey, you're doing well. Hey, you look good today.
Like a compliment.
Exactly. Or a compliment. Or I'm so proud of the show you recorded the other day. It sounded so well. I enjoyed it. All these things, it just lifts a person's spirit.
Yes.
And they're like, oh, wow, I'm not a insignificant, unimportant, unworthy piece of nothingness on the face of earth,
yes.
you know?
Okay, thank you very much, Brother
You're
Iman
welcome.
And Sister Zainab. Thank you very much for listening to us.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, يا ربي let the ummah rise again, let us see daylight again, once again.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com www.iribi.org/en. Around the World with Reporters. In London, thousands hit the streets, furious at Israel demanding an end to the continued onslaught of Palestinians, while incensed at the evident bias in much of the mainstream media coverage, which is accused of shamelessly pushing the Israeli narrative.
There's a well-established channel between the Israeli government and between all mainstream news sources, meaning that they get threatened with legal action, they get aggressive emails and letters and even tweets from members of the Israeli government.
All the media pretty much has been disgraceful, and they buy this narrative that these are clashes between two hostile camps that are completely incomprehensible, as if, you know, both sides are equally culpable. What is happening here is a continuation, a deepening, an acceleration of Israeli aggression.
Organisations like the BBC, funded by the British taxpayer, claim to be impartial, but have come under fire for presenting the murder of Palestinians as an equal conflict of two sides, and in the past of yielding to Israeli pressure over the nature of their coverage, and of simply not doing their job of reporting the truth of the reality of the war against the Palestinians. While Israel shows no sign of stopping the attacks on Palestinian men, women and children, millions around the world are demanding an end to the slaughter, and that mainstream media, which maintains incredible influence over public opinion, tell the facts and the truth about the devastating, deadly impact of the brutalization of the Palestinians.
As Israeli occupation forces continue to kill innocent Palestinians, media outlets like the BBC stand accused of siding with Israel, presenting a false narrative which is a far cry from reality. Richard Sudam, London.
The legacy of the past in the north of Ireland still haunts the present, particularly as the victims of the violence are still searching for the truth. For the family of those killed in the Ballymurphy massacre in 1971, their fight, first and foremost, was to set the record straight, and after 50 long years, their wait was finally over. As a coroner inquest ruled that 10 civilians, including a mother of 8 and a Catholic priest, killed across 3 days, were entirely innocent. The inquest found that at least 9 of the 10 killed were shot by the British Army, and that the force used was disproportionate, considering the paratroopers were firing from protected positions from a long distance away.
The coroner's court heard almost 100 days of evidence from more than 150 witnesses to conclude what the families of the deceased have known for 50 years, that their loved ones were entirely innocent and should not have been shot dead that day. But why have they had to wait so long for this verdict?
While the families have been vindicated, the fight to bring the perpetrators to justice is still not over, according to Patrick O'Murray, a human rights lawyer who represents them.
Prosecutions have been very rare in this jurisdiction, arising from the conflict when those who perpetrated the events are state actors. Many families would argue that we have had a de facto amnesty for British soldiers and police officers, where they haven't been subject to the normal rules of the criminal justice system or the rigours of the law.
The families feel their loved ones were killed twice, first by the British soldiers, and then their characters assassinated by the British state. Inside and outside the court, the families cheered the fact that after a long and hard-fought battle, the truth had been acknowledged and the names of their loved ones exonerated. But their cheers were bittersweet because not everyone lived long enough to see this day. Ahmed Cabello, London.
In the wake of the Israeli regime's attacks on Jerusalem al-Quds, pro-Palestinian demonstrators took over Downing Street in the British capital, London. The demonstrators even managed to clear out a small group of pro-Zionist demonstrators and chanted in solidarity with the Palestinian uprising against the occupation, sending a strong message of international solidarity.
Outrage is what's being voiced here on the streets of London today after Israel's assault on the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Jerusalem Al-Quds, as well as the attacks and the eviction of Palestinians from their homes in the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. On top of that as well, of course, people are voicing their frustration and condemnation of the British silence over the massacres committed in the Gaza Strip.
Now they're attacking the Gaza Strip as well. They're attacking the Al-Aqsa Mosque at a time when, in the middle of Ramadan, at the most holy time for the Muslim people. This is an acceleration of the general attacks on the Palestinians, and it's completely unacceptable.
Since 1917, the British government has supported the Zionist project in Palestine, the settler colonial project that expelled the Arab Palestinians from their land, and which to this day continues to deny them their basic human rights. And today, now we see Israel is continuing this and ramping it up and is now trying to expel people from Jerusalem, from East Jerusalem, which is occupied by Israel illegally.
Demonstrators also expressed their outrage over Britain's allowing for the production of weapons to be used by the Israeli military and the UK's historic support for Israel.
According to the arms trade treaty that Britain is a signatory on, they are legally obliged to assess whether the hardware that they're selling to another country is likely to be used for human rights violations. When, following the 2014 war in Gaza, where you saw the massacre in Shaja'iyah, Britain, within weeks of it, Vince Cable, the business secretary, rubber-stamped the sales of millions of pounds of weaponry to Israel.
With the Gaza Strip under bombardment as the armed resistance fires rockets at Israel, the Palestinian people rise up throughout the occupied territories. This is whilst the international solidarity seems to now be stronger than ever. Robert and Lakesh, London.
Iran, Tehran, the Interior Ministry, the elections office of the country which is now registering the hopefuls for the upcoming June presidential elections. Over 20 public figures have officially announced their intention to run for president, but the final list of candidates will be announced by the Constitution Council on May 27th. This man was the first luminary showing up, Mohammad Hassan Nami, an army general who ministered telecoms during President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. He told at a brief presser that he has tens of plans for the country's future, especially in the economic fields.
I have 62 programs for my administration when I would be elected. The main six ones will be performed within the first 6 months of my term. It mainly focuses on improving the life quality of people, especially in economic terms.
The next salient figure who signed up on the first day was Saeed Mohammad, another man with military backgrounds who has served as the commander of the IRGC's construction base.
My likely government will certainly abide by the agreements reached by the incumbent administration. So as the 2015 nuclear deal is an international deal, we will comply with our commitments. This is the other side that has withdrawn from the pact unilaterally.
The third one was the former defense minister of President Hassan Rouhani, who is now serving as an advisor to the leader of the Islamic Revolution.
Particularly with regard to the public livelihood, people's livelihood. Well, that has so much details, but within 2 years, I will be in contact with different associations, guilds, and the university professors. So I have had face-to-face talks with them in the past 2 years, and that has been delineated on the basis of the facts and realities in the society.
Apart from these three, Wahab Azizi, Secretary General of Jihad Garan Party, and Mohammad Zarif Fumani, Secretary General of Popular Party of Reforms, appeared to announce their bid. Some top political figures are also seen as possible presidential hopefuls, but they have not declared their decision yet. They include former Parliament Speaker Ali Larijani, Judiciary Chief Sayyid Ibrahim Raisi, current Parliament Speaker Mohammad Baqir Qalibaf, and Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif. The new interpretation of the Constitutional Council of the Election Law says that runners must be between 40 and 75 years of age with at least 4 years of managerial experience with no criminal records. This as the former military personnel must have served as major general. With these conditions in, several of the current hopefuls may be out of the race. Human Abedi, Tehran.
Messages of sympathy with the Afghan nation echoed from Tehran following the deadly terrorist raid on Saturday that killed dozens of schoolgirls in Kabul. Scores of people lost their lives in explosions caused by car bomb and mortar shells targeting a school in the Shia-majority neighborhood of Dasht-e-Barchi in western Kabul. Eyewitnesses reported that the victims of the attack were mostly female students headed on their way back home after finishing school.
I offer my condolences to the bereaved mothers of the innocent girls who lost their lives in the terrorist attack. I hold the Afghan government responsible for its inaction regarding terrorism and extremism.
We came here to express our sympathy with our fellow Afghan citizens. The fact that the terrorists committed to this heinous crime in the fasting month of Ramadan shows that they have no respect for Muslim citizens.
While Daesh terrorists have claimed responsibility for the Kabul attack, demonstrators here blame the incident on U.S. war of Afghanistan. They say American forces have been on the ground in Afghanistan under the pretext of fighting terrorism. But in fact, they've been fueling the flames of terrorism. Last week, the U.S. and its NATO allies began pulling their troops and military hardware out of Afghanistan, a measure which these people say is too late.
The U.S. is not willing to lose its foothold in Afghanistan, so it is always after creating chaos and insecurity by finding the extremists. They believe this way, Afghan people want American troops to stay to protect them against terrorists.
The U.S. is not willing to lose its foothold in Afghanistan, so it's always after creating chaos and insecurity by funding the extremists. They believe this way, Afghan people want American troops to stay to protect them against terrorists.
In a gesture of solidarity, Tehran also held this video mapping on its iconic Azadi Tower. The video projection depicted messages of sympathy with the Afghan nation.
A voice to lead, a vision for future. This is the theme for the 2021 World Nurses Day. Iran has commemorated the international occasion as this year, like the previous year, the occasion is marked with a new awareness among the public and officials as nurses, along with other health workers, take the front line in the fight against the deadly coronavirus pandemic. Speaking at a press conference on the occasion, head of Iran's nursing organization, Mohammad Mirzabeghi, said since the outbreak of the COVID-19 pandemic, over 100,000 Iranian nurses have been infected with the deadly virus, but Iranian nurses have not quit their jobs.
Since the outbreak of the coronavirus epidemic, Iranian nurses have been at the forefront of the fight against the disease. More than 100,000 of them have so far caught the virus on duty, out of which 120 died of the virus. On average, 6,000 to 7,000 nurses are under quarantine due to getting infected with the virus. But as soon as they get recovered, they come back to work to take care of the patients. Such a spirit creates a beautiful picture of sacrifice in one's mind.
There are some 140,000 nurses in Iran. For hospital nurses, life under the coronavirus conditions has been much tougher and more challenging. These professional nurses have had to work extra shifts to make up for the shortage of staff.
I've been a nurse for 12 years, but the COVID-19 pandemic was the worst of what I had ever seen. I saw my colleagues losing their lives on a daily basis at the front line of the fight against the virus. Therefore, I decided to take photos of their sacrifices and hard-working efforts to take care of infected patients. My photo was selected by the International Council of Nurses as the best photo of the year in hospital category.
This global COVID-19 pandemic has shown the world the important role that nurses play in keeping people healthy across the lifespan. Therefore, nurses as the largest healthcare profession must play an integral part in planning the future of healthcare. The World Health Organization designated 2020 as the Year of Nurses to celebrate the contributions of nurses to healthcare during the pandemic and acknowledge the challenges they continue to face as the pandemic ebbs and flows through human community worldwide. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
The escalation of the Israeli aggression against the Palestinian people is awakening the people of the world to the true face of the regime and prompting people from all walks of life to emerge and raise their voices.
The women and the children, we all know, is disproportionately impacted by the violence that is happening in Al-Aqsa. And I think as women that we need to be able to stand with those women in solidarity, and that is why I'm here today.
I think the atrocities of the Al-Aqsa Mosque or a demonstration of insecurity and of awareness that the light at the end of the tunnel for Israel, for a Zionist state, is an oncoming train. For us, it's the daylight. The next phase in the struggle is drawing to an end.
South Africans have always highlighted the plight of Palestinians with numerous marches held to demand a stronger action from the government. While the ruling ANC has taken several policy decisions in this regard, it has largely failed to sign them into law. However, lobbyists are expected to put forward a bill in Parliament that will seek a boycott of Israel.
We want Parliament to discuss it as soon as possible and to adopt laws which will force everyone in South Africa, big business, universities, sports bodies, to have nothing to do with Israel.
The South African government has condemned the Israeli forces' raid on the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound and the planned evictions in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of East Jerusalem Al-Quds. It slammed the move as being in breach of international law and several UN Security Council resolutions. But the country is yet to indicate any plan to downscale ties with Tel Aviv. The demonstration year forms part of a national day of action in which sister protests have taken place in Johannesburg, Durban, and other parts of the country. Protesters say they will continue their action until the government takes decisive steps. Hassan Siri, Cape Town.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip held funerals for civilians killed in Israeli airstrikes that targeted residential areas in different parts of the enclave. The Israeli army launched the attacks on the Gaza Strip on Monday. Children are also among the victims.
My relatives were playing next to their home and the Israeli airplanes hit them and killed some of them. We are really sad, but we are ready to sacrifice anything for Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. It's our right and we are going to grab it from Israel by force, even if we die defending Palestine. We ask the resistance to respond.
God is greater than Israel. I lost my little son while my husband lost his legs. I'm totally speechless and I can't believe this till this moment.
The ongoing wave of violence broke out on Monday after Hamas issued an ultimatum demanding Israel remove its forces from Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. The Israeli airstrikes came after resistance groups in the Gaza Strip conducted rocket attacks against Israel.
Palestinian resistance will keep defending Palestinians with all means. What is happening in Jerusalem al-Quds is a crime, and the Israeli regime should get the punishment from Palestinians for attacking worshippers in holy places. Israeli regime is practicing terrorism policies in Jerusalem al-Quds and the Gaza Strip.
Palestinians have gathered here to mourn some of those who were killed in Israeli raids. As Israel keeps bombing and killing Palestinians, people here call on the international community to confront the Israeli aggression against Palestinians. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Hundreds of Palestinians were wounded after Israeli forces stormed Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Jerusalem, Al-Quds. This was the latest in a series of confrontations in the Holy City. Palestinian worshippers gathered at the mosque's courtyard after performing morning prayers to prevent a planned raid by Israeli settlers later Monday as part of their activities to mark what they call Jerusalem Day. It's the day when East Jerusalem, Al-Quds, was occupied in 1967 and later annexed by Israel. Israeli forces raided the courtyards, firing tear gas, stun grenades, and rubber bullets against Palestinians to force them out of the holy site. However, the Palestinians remained steadfast.
What is going on in Al-Quds is a massacre, a comprehensive war to evacuate the city from its real residents. Palestinians across the world don't remain silent. People in Al-Quds are clashing with the occupation forces to defend the Al-Aqsa Mosque. They will never allow the settlers to desecrate their holy site.
After the clashes, Israeli forces decided to change the path of the Jerusalem Day flag march, so the settlers had to march through the old town's streets. The latest confrontations follow days of clashes between Palestinians and Israeli forces in the Jerusalem.